Bob, while I was dating Terry, was also going with me on many of those weekends to Seattle, and he dated Terry's cousin, first cousin, the one that was happened to be busy, and therefore I was fixed up with Terry instead of her first cousin. Bob subsequently married, did not marry the first cousin, he married somebody else. But he was a good friend of mine. There were only, he and I were the only Jewish officers in Spokane at our base. Terry's from a family that had four children. She has an older sister who is about 3 years older than Terry, and an older brother who's about 2 years older than Terry. She also had a younger brother. Her younger brother was maybe 15 years younger than Terry. And unfortunately, he had muscular dystrophy, Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And he died when he was 18 years old. In one of those ironies or coincidences, he died on the same morning that our middle daughter was born, same day. There are just, Terry just has two siblings now. Her older sister's name is Natalie. Now it's Natalie Malin, but she was married to a fellow named Goldfarb before. They have a couple of children. And her brother, his name is Herb, Herb Thomas, and they both still live in Seattle. And in fact, when we got married and moved to Pittsburgh, the only members of Terry's family at that time who did not live in Seattle, and she comes from a very large family, were her brother and sister-in-law and their four children, and they lived in Spokane, Washington, and they subsequently moved back to Seattle. So we became known as the relatives back east. We dated for about 6 months before we got engaged. I don't know if I told you the story about my call to my mother.
No.
When we got engaged.
I don't think so.
I was in Spokane. My parents, of course, were in Cleveland. And I called my mother. Did I tell you this story?
The name?
About the name?
Oh, yes.
Is she Jewish?
Uh-huh.
Okay, I did tell
her. But
you
didn't
story.
She know that you were dating in those
she,
6 months? Well, when you
she
were going
knew that
back
I was going,
oh.
going out, but
oh,
about,
uh-huh.
not really
uh-huh.
at that time. But I did tell you the story on tape.
That's right. You can, why don't you tell us
repeat
again?
It? Uh-huh. I called my mother and father, and told them I was getting engaged. And they said, what's the girl's name? I think they said, what's the young lady's name? And I said, her name is Terry Thomas. And there's a pause on the phone, and then my mother says, is she Jewish? And I said to my mother, of course she's Jewish. And there's another pause, and my mother says, are you sure? on that. Terry's actual name.
There's an old joke with that, but I don't
yeah,
know.
Terry's actual name is legal name is Tilly. She has an aunt, Tilly, who happened not to be in Seattle when Terry was born because her aunt Tilly says that she would never have allowed any niece of hers, any niece of hers to be named Tilly if she had been there at the time. So we were engaged in December. I had already accepted a job in Pittsburgh. I came back to Pittsburgh to interview, also to Chicago and Cleveland, to interview in the fall of 1960, late fall of 1960, and then came back to Seattle, and we got engaged about a month later. And originally we were going to get married in the winter, February, and then my parents couldn't come out then, so the rest of the family couldn't come out, so we waited until June, and we got married on June 25th, 1961, in Seattle.
And And then you moved to Pittsburgh right after?
When we got married, I only had 8 weeks left in the military.
Mm-hmm.
We went on a honeymoon for a week up in Banff, at the Banff Springs Hotel in Banff, in Canada. And then came back, and by that time I had 7 weeks to go. And my boss gave me an assignment. We had had an officer who was stationed at one of our radar stations up in Canada, North American Air Defense Command. And this officer had gotten on the phone on more than one evening, several evenings in a row, and had made some unauthorized telephone calls around the country on the unrestricted telephone lines they had there, and also into Canada, and had made lewd and obscene suggestions to various telephone operators, including some operators at the headquarters of the Canadian Air Force, which was somewhere in the east. And so they wanted somebody to go up to investigate this and be the investigating officer. I had only a short time to go, and he said, if you want to do it, why don't you do it, and instead of flying up to this base, why don't you drive up there? It was a good 2-day drive each way, and he said, if you get started early, you can sort of have a second honeymoon on the thing. So Terry and I drove up to this station for me to do the investigation, and took 2 days going up and 3 days coming back. And we were up there 2 or 3 days. PS's officer eventually was allowed to resign his commission. He had been in the Air Force and was an officer in the Air Force for over 15 years when this occurred. He was allowed to resign his commission. It was a very interesting way to spend a little over a week. And by the time I got back from that, there were only 3 or 4 weeks left, and to the last 2 years off traveling. So we took a long trip when we got out of the Air Force. We drove to Seattle for a weekend, and then we drove down the coast to San Francisco, and then to Los Angeles, and then to Las Vegas, where I had an aunt and uncle living and some cousins. And then we drove across the country to Cleveland. Stayed overnight in Cleveland, came down to Pittsburgh, found an apartment, went back to Cleveland for a big reception that my parents put on, and then came back to Pittsburgh to start working there. So we took about 2 or 3 weeks on that.
Big adjustment for Terry to move?
Tremendous
to
adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
Except for one trip to Utah with her parents or her father, some years earlier, Terry had never been and except for the fact that she had gone to the University of Colorado in Boulder for a year, she had never been east of Denver. She had never been to California. She had basically stayed in the Pacific Northwest, and so when we went on this long trip, everything was new. San Francisco was new, Los Angeles was new, Las Vegas was new, and of course everything in the East was new. And she didn't know anyone in Pittsburgh when we arrived here. The only ones she knew in Cleveland were my parents and my brother, who I think was away at school at the time. And so there really wasn't anybody that she knew. We moved to Pittsburgh and found an apartment on Fifth Avenue, in one of the old apartments on Fifth Avenue, Fifth and Ivy, and a third floor walk up. Seattle's a pretty new city. Everything is new, not everything, but most things are new. Apartments are certainly new. When we drove into Pittsburgh from Cleveland, we came down Route 19. Of course, there was no interstate coming in at the time, and I didn't know my way around Pittsburgh. So Terry and I drove down Route 19 and came to the point. And the B&O scrap yards were where the current stadium is, where Three Rivers Stadium is. And there were these mounds of scrap iron. And then there was the old bridge from the north side over to the point, which by that time had, it was just before it was torn down, had wooden planks on it, and a temporary wooden-reinforced steel ramp off into the point. The point was ripped up. There was no park there. It was, they were just preparing the park. It was all ripped up. And so we come in, and there are these scrap, big scrap heaps over this rickety bridge with down into a torn-up point. And then I had to get out to Oakland. We were staying at a motel in Oakland, in the university area that no longer exists. And I looked at the map, and the easiest way to get to Oakland is go right out Fifth Avenue with all of its trolley tracks. So we came through the downtown and right out Fifth Avenue with all the trolley tracks out to Oakland. And by the time we got to Oakland, I think she was ready to go back to Seattle on that, because we had no idea any direction. We had one. I had one friend, in, other than people in the firm, I had one friend in Pittsburgh, a fellow named Robert Heiser, who I'd grown up with and who was getting his PhD in pharmacy administration at the University of Pittsburgh. And he had been an AZA friend of mine. And so we got to know, Terry got to know the Heisers, and we immediately joined the Temple. Immediately joined Rota Scholem within, I think, within 2 weeks of the time we got here, we joined. Time for the high holidays, but we mainly joined, first of all, I was used to large congregations, but in addition to that, we joined because of the junior congregation. That was a quick way to meet people. The first people we met after we got to Pittsburgh, within the first week that we were in Pittsburgh, were Alan and Frankie Lefkowitz. They're friends to this day. So we met them, and we met a lot of our friends who are now friends of ours, people who are now friends of ours, through the junior congregation at Rota Scholem.
How did you happen to join Rota Scholem? I guess what I was really wondering is, why do so few young people not take advantage of those kinds of needs today, even
for
social
reasons? They do. I think they still do. The junior congregation at Rota Scholem, the last time I looked, which was 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I'll see again tonight, was, had 160 family units, which is about the same size as it was then.
But how did you know about it coming in, whereas a lot of people might not know?
I had contacted the rabbi at Fairmount Temple in Cleveland, which is the congregation that my family belonged to and that I'd grown up with, and before I came here. Talked with him about, very briefly, about the fact that I was moving to Pittsburgh, and did he have any congregation to recommend? And of course, being the diplomat that he was, he said, well, there are a number of fine congregations there, but the one that has the most preeminent rabbi is Rota Scholem in Pittsburgh, which I probably had never heard of before then. And Dr. Freehoff, who I had heard of before then. And so that was the reason, based on that recommendation. But I would probably have joined even Rota Scholem regardless, because I was used to big congregations. I'd grown up in a big congregation. I was used to all the things of large congregation been offered. There are pros and cons, in my judgment, of belonging to a large versus a small congregation. I think in small congregations you have a greater chance of making an impact, and you have a greater chance of having very close friends and knowing more a higher percentage of the people in the congregation.
But in a small congregation, they don't have, generally speaking, the kind of resources that the large congregations do. And this would be true in the conservative movement also, sure. I suspect in the Orthodox movement. And when you have the kind of resources that a Rode of Shalom or that a Fairmount in Cleveland has, mm-hmm. you tend to get speakers and you tend to get other benefits that are difficult to come by in a smaller mm-hmm. congregation. Some people love small congregations, and I can understand why, mm-hmm. but I happen to like the larger size congregations.
But you joined... When you joined Rav Shalom and joining the junior congregation, you really have a small congregation.
Well, you joined a small congregation within a large congregation. Rav Shalom was bigger then than it is now. I don't know what the numbers were in 1961, but my guess is that at that time it probably had over 1,800 families. It probably was close to 2,000.
What is it now?
It's about 1,600 families. Been stable at 1,600 families for the last number of years, but it was larger at that time. It conducted the High Holidays services both in the main sanctuary and the Syria Mosque, mm-hmm. and had two services in each place. Now we no longer use, of course there is no Syria Mosque, but we no longer use facilities outside the temple building itself.
So your social life really evolved from the junior congregation?
Except for that portion of our social life that revolves around people within the firm, mm-hmm. Almost all of our very close friends we met through the junior congregation. Mm-hmm. And our social life has evolved around that.
We're sitting in the offices, the beautiful offices of Eckerd Siemens on the 42nd floor of the U.S. Steel Building. And as we look out the window, we can see the point and the top of what was formerly the golf building.
Right. The top of the conference
building. And the Three Rivers. Will you tell us about your first... you first came here?
We came to Pittsburgh, and as I say, we went back to Cleveland after... We came down here to find an apartment. We found an apartment, which my wife thought was something out of the medieval days. And we went back to Cleveland for a big reception that my parents threw for us. And then we came back to Pittsburgh, and we started work in the apartment. We started working and started living in this apartment. We had almost no furniture. Initially, we had a couple of folding cots that we slept on for a few days until mattresses came. We had a bridge table and four bridge chairs. One of my associates here in the firm offered me an easy chair that would find its way as a premium seating in a bar and lounge in some third class city somewhere, fake plastic cover, and literally that's all we had for the first week or two. The first night we were in the apartment, there was a couple living below us who we had not met, and we went to sleep, and of course these cots are on wooden floors with no carpets or anything, and as you move around, the cot sort of scrapes along the floor, and after about a half hour after we were in bed, there's a knock on the door. And it's the woman from downstairs in her bathrobe, and she said, "I know that you have just moved in, but do you think you could not scrape the furniture across the floor?" I mean, that's how there were no carpets or anything in this place. It also got very hot that week. It was this early September, late August, early September, 1961. It got very hot. And we were on the top floor, and so we went out and bought an air conditioner. The first thing we bought was a little window-type air conditioning unit. I promptly got sick. You know, I was sick for 2 or 3 days there. But because I was new on the job, I dragged myself into work. The first few days were not what one would want to call glorious days on that. Shortly after we moved to Pittsburgh, a friend of mine from the military came through and asked if he could stay with us. We, by this time, had the cots were in the guest room. And we said yes. I was a member of the Ohio Bar, but of course I hadn't taken the Pennsylvania Bar yet. And so I was going to school 3 or 4 nights a week after work. And so he came to stay with us, and he would have dinner with Terry while I stayed downtown and grabbed a bite to eat and went to the bar. Went to the bar, of course, downtown in the old Sherwin Hotel. They put me right to work.
What kind of work did you start with here?
Well, in those days, you didn't specialize. That's not universally true, but generally speaking, you did everything. And so in the early years that I was in practice, I did everything from drafting contracts to working on litigation to working on antitrust matters to a little bit of labor work and so forth. There were 3 files sitting on my desk when I first arrived. We represented Mount Lebanon Township, and there was a file in connection with the sidewalks on Beetling Road, which the township had put in. This concrete had promptly spalled and broken up. The township had assessed the property owners for the sidewalks. They now had to be replaced again. There was a lawsuit, a potential lawsuit against the contractor, which is what I was called into work on. But in the meantime, they were going to assess the property owners a second time. And so we had 2 different aspects of that. A Westinghouse file was on my desk also. It was a file in connection with a major dispute that Westinghouse had with the Tennessee Valley Authority over the turbines that Westinghouse had sold to TVA. The TVA claim did not meet the warranty in the turbines. So the first business trip I ever took was a trip to South Philadelphia, where Westinghouse had its turbine and generator facility. A turbine facility to watch and see how they manufacture turbines and get a lesson in turbines. The third file on my desk was a contract file, not for Westinghouse, but for a small client who had a contract in connection with the reconstruction of the Shippingport nuclear power facility down in Shippingport, Pennsylvania. So the second tour I had, about a week after the first one, was of the Shippingport nuclear power reactor. And this was a contract dispute with the Navy over cost overruns in the Navy.
How many attorneys were with Eckert Siemens at that time?
When I came in 1961, I was the 14th attorney to come. Actually, 3 of us came at the same time. I preceded the others by about a week. One of the lawyers was facing military service. He was with us for about 8 months and then left to go to military service. Didn't rejoin us for many years. The other lawyer was with us for about 5 or so years and then left to join a in-house staff of an insurance firm in Philadelphia.
And how many are there?
Today we have 240 lawyers in 10 cities. The firm started in 1958 with 8 lawyers who were a breakaway from the old Smith Buchanan firm. 8 lawyers plus Mr. Smith, so 9 lawyers. Mr. Smith was a consul. And by the time I got there, I was the 14th lawyer to come. Westinghouse and Alcoa were the principal clients. Alcoa was the signature client of the firm. They were the reason the firm was able to exist. They were the major client of the firm. Westinghouse became a very significant client, in some years as significant as Alcoa. Westinghouse is still a client, and this year will probably be the largest client of the firm again. Some years they are, and some years they aren't.
Alcoa is who we do some work for now, but they are no longer the principal client.
In those days, did Alcoa and Westinghouse still had in-house counsel?
Yes, but in-house counsel staff in the early 1960s was different than it is today. First of all, they were very small. Alcoa, I don't know how big it was, their in-house staff, but it was very tiny. So almost everything was farmed out. The Westinghouse in-house staff was also very small, so that on any matter of any significance, they were using outside counsel. And what they were doing basically was coordinating outside counsel.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas today, in-house counsel staffs tend to be larger, and they not only do the coordination of outside counsel work, because there's still outside counsel work, obviously, but they also today, in-house counsel do a lot of the work that is more than just coordinating. They draft contracts, they negotiate contracts, they handle some aspects of litigation, and so forth. So it's a lot different than it was then. But both Alcoa and Westinghouse, each of them had in-house counsel.
In retrospect, does it seem that the two files that were on your desk, the two of which were from Westinghouse, did that seem unusual for those kinds of files to be going to a very junior?
No, on the TVA, the only one was for Westinghouse. On the Westinghouse TVA case, we had a team of four lawyers. Mm-hmm. There was a senior partner, Frank Siemens was the senior partner on it. There was a young partner, and two associates, one associate on the facts and one associate on the law. And I was the associate on the facts side of the investigation. And so I was working for the senior partner. On the each of the other two matters, the Mount Lebanon matter, again, I was working for Mr. Siemens. And on the matter relating to shipping port, I was working for one of our other senior partners. So I wasn't off on my own doing that. And as I say, we did a lot of different things over the years, in the early years, a lot of different types of legal work. They used to enforce the antitrust laws in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And the Robinson-Patman Act, which is a price discrimination act, anti-price discrimination act, was a major factor, and I used to get involved in Robinson-Patman Act matters. We used to do a lot of contracts for Alcoa. At one time I had 20 or 25 binders here, three-ring notebooks, one-inch notebooks, with nothing but all of the contracts I ever did for Alcoa, one after the other.
Wow.
The index probably had 250 contracts. So it was about 250 contracts so far. We reviewed advertisements for false advertising. I flew on at least two occasions that I remember to New York to go to the studios where they were cutting television commercials to review advertising that Alcoa was going to put on the air for deceptive advertising from a legal standpoint. And
we used to do a lot of that here with the storybooks and stuff. I think you show us the ads here.
Mm-hmm.
There were just all types, all different kinds of people were. I did some tax work for Carl Jr. I had both basic and advanced tax in law school, but after doing two or three tax matters with Carl, I think we mutually decided that I was not going to be a tax attorney. And so I did not pursue that area there after that. In the civil law area, there was literally very little. One of the great things about the firm then was the senior partners were all very different. It is hard to imagine two personalities and two styles of practice of law more at opposite poles than Bill Eckert and Zeke Siemens. Bill Eckert was a very quiet, reserved, all lawyer, all the time. He was a perfectionist. He was a great lawyer on appellate work. But other than his roses, which tended to his home, the law was his entire life. At least as far as I know, no small talk with Bill Eckert. Very conservative individual. Very watchful of every penny. Highly respected of the lawyer for the brilliance of the way he practiced law. Frank Siemens, on the other hand, was an individual who, when you were in his presence, just made you feel good. He was just an outgoing, ebullient type of personality.